Welcome to the ANews podcast. This is episode 93 for December 7th, 2018. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us email feedback and constructive criticism at podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, go to the non-sectarian, though not unbiased, anarchistnews.org. What's new this week? Still not sorry on the plea deal in the Lock Street case. From Anonymous by two Hamilton anarchists. For those who don't remember, the Lock Street case is the result of some property destruction in Hamilton, Ontario, which had an intense amount of pushback in the media and resulted in anarchist spaces in Hamilton being damaged, etc. This is a fiery and articulate explanation of why a plea deal and what the plea deal entails, as well as some surrounding issues. This article is a signpost on the road some of us walk between we're screwed and we still do things. And despite accepting a plea, I also see it as somewhere in the terrain of the Greek example of never pleading innocence. They will never find us innocent. They will just make us deny ourselves. Quote, "We reject any division between ideas and actions, and we stand by all the activities that took place on the weekend of March 3rd, the book fair, the demo, and more, all those acts that were criminalized and all those that weren't. While we have no interest in making distinctions between those who broke shit and those who didn't, it's important to note that this was not, and it rarely ever is, just about a singular action. Those of us facing charges in Hamilton weren't primarily targeted on the basis of breaking anything, but rather because we visibly and persistently push anarchist ideas and practices that are fundamentally at odds with the vision the ruling class and their lackeys have for the city. We could choose to be outraged about the criminalization of protest and of routine organizing tasks, like distributing leaflets, but this would be to say that the state is wrong to perceive those acts as threats to its interests. Every reading group, public meal, gathering, march, etc., is as much a part of our refusal to have our lives managed by bureaucrats and capitalists as the act of throwing rocks through a window. The state will attack whatever parts of resistance it can, and since security practices during actions are often effective, that repression tends to focus on the activity done completely openly." Unquote.
A Infos, keeping the torch burning for the 24th year. From A Infos by Andrew Flood. Oh dear. Well, from one old-timer about another, I get the desire to celebrate, or at least acknowledge, anarchist projects that have lasted, and the unapologetic, if slightly defensive, explanation of how the aging design of A-Infos makes sense in a so rapidly changing world is at least a small window on some decisions that long-lasting projects need to make. Does one expect one's grandmother to wear jeggings and Uggs? Have I just dated myself with even those examples? Quote, "This isn't simply a question of using new communication technology. It's also a question of understanding how that technology has already remade social relations to the extent that the society of 2018 is radically different from the society of 1990. So different that a lot of the old methods simply don't work very well anymore, as they require different sorts of people for them to work. There is an extent to which the archaic form A-Infos retained from the mid-1990s isn't that much of a disadvantage in 2018, as the pace of change over the years since has been so rapid that each new innovation has only remained current for a couple of years before it is replaced by the next. During the summit protest period of the early 2000s, a few of us had a somewhat serious conversation over drinks at a counter-summit event trying to work out if at that point we could provide live video news from the front line of protests. It was technically possible, but would have required about 50,000 euro worth of extra equipment and satellite hire. Today, almost everyone has all the needed equipment in their pocket." Unquote. Anyway, anarchism is huge. It is good that there are lasting projects that are breadcrumbs of a sort to how we got here. Whoever we is, and whatever here is. It's a little strange that Flood sounds like he's proposing that A-Infos become an indie media project, but indie media projects could probably stand some more attention. So get those longevity folks together with the tech-savvy folks. Maybe something will happen.
Anarchist prisoner Sean Swain sexually assaulted by correctional officer, from It's Going Down. An urgent update from Sean, and it's not good news. He comes out as a sexual assault survivor, most significant to him at this point because the assaulter continues to harass him. Quote, "I haven't talked about this. It was humiliating. But not talking about it makes me an accomplice. I have no way of knowing if Trevor Clark has done this, or worse, to others. So please get this everywhere." Unquote. Sean requests a call-in campaign, complete with script, asking to get this guard off his back and perhaps the backs of other prisoners as well. The email of the person to contact is included for those of us who prefer to write, although, of course, that's less effective. Call! Also, write an anarchist prisoner today.
The Anarchism of Blackness, a review by Wayne Price from Anarchismo. This is a review of an interesting little book that has a disappointing comment thread, which is perhaps predictable, as the review doesn't ask or answer questions that are particularly interesting. Although it is definitely a review, as it brings perspective and knowledge to the topic, rather than just giving a thumbnail about what the book is about. It's easy to get into a finger-pointing mess with what I'm about to do, but it seems significant as an indication of things to look for, so I will go there. The title of this review is actually, as Price notes, the title of an article by one of the authors of the book. It is an article that predates the book, and is obviously in relation to the book. To name the review after the article seems deeply disrespectful on two levels. One, and most obviously, it's Price yanking a phrase away from the creator of that phrase, with no explanation, much less justification in the review. That's both sloppy and rude, and some other more dramatic word that usually takes conversations in boring directions, so I'll stop there. My second problem just with the name of the review is much more minor, especially in the shadow of my first problem. But the title also conflates the book with the article in a way that seems inappropriate to the authors of the book. If they wanted to call the book that, then they would have. Price's title removes any distance they're trying to get between the article and the book, and acts like they don't get to do that. Aside from that, Price does his regular thing of red anarchying / class warfaring all over everything, which I just don't care about too much, because we all know who he is and where he comes from. Or if we don't, we only need to read any one of his many articles and it becomes painfully clear. Quote, "The book lacks a strategy for African-American liberation beyond broad insights. People may ask for answers as though there are distinct formulas. The solution to capitalism is anti-capitalism. The solution to white supremacy is the active rejection of it and the dual affirmation of indigenous sovereignty and black humanity. This is not good enough." Unquote. Uh-huh.
International call for New Year's Eve noise demonstrations from NYC Anarchist Black Cross. A call in English and Spanish for prisoner solidarity actions on New Year's, as has become traditional in some areas. Quote, "This is a call for a raucous night of strong solidarity with those imprisoned by the state on one of the noisiest nights of the year. On New Year's Eve, gather your crew, collective, community, organization, or just yourself, and come together to raise a racket and remind those on the inside that they are not alone. Internationally, noise demonstrations outside of prisons are a way to remember those who are held captive by the state and a way to show solidarity with imprisoned comrades and loved ones. We come together to break the loneliness and isolation. We know that prison is beyond reform and must be completely abolished. It is a mechanism of repression used by the state to maintain a social order rooted in white supremacy, patriarchy, and heteronormativity. To come together outside of the sites of repression is also to stand in defiance of what they represent." Unquote.
Paris, cars burned, though not in solidarity with yellow jackets. A communique translated from the website attaque.noblogs.org, a French site that, quote, "chronicles the social war in France," unquote. This is a report that will feel very familiar to any critical anarchist who has lived through popular uprisings in their country. In so many words, yeah, it's cool that people are in the streets, but their power dynamics suck, and we're not confused about it. Quote, "The barricades on the Champs-Élysées are not hiding confusion. The smashy-smashy cannot replace anti-authoritarian ideas. We were in the streets back in 2016, and will be again, but not for the purpose of defending the old world and its cars. And we believe that many other possibilities exist. We only have to look for those." Unquote. A car was burned.
A brief note on the Yellow Vest movement, from its going down. Regardless of the flavor of anarchist, IGD always errs on the side of people in the streets, and this is no different. Quote, "Occupying the same spaces as the far right seems like a strange position for anarchists to be in. However, I personally support the anarchist presence in the movement, and I'll briefly explain why. Dot, dot, dot. The anarchist approach is to address climate change at its root cause by acknowledging the underlying structures of domination that lead to environmental destruction in the first place, namely capitalism and the state. Instead of offsetting the cost of pollution fuels onto people, anarchists propose to minimize our dependence on fossil fuels by providing alternatives and attacking the concentration of corporate and state power that forces people into being dependent on fossil fuels for their livelihoods, for example, forcing them to travel long distances on a daily basis for work. Today, production isn't local and decentralized. Rather, concentrated power has produced a core and periphery which necessitates the long-distance movement of millions of people and goods on a daily basis, unquote, etc.
On the Gilets Jaunes, dispatches from France, from commonsitu.wordpress.com. Commies get together and analyze. Quote, in the last few days, the left has struggled to politically apprehend a new phenomenon called the Yellow Vest, Gilets Jaunes, since it does not emerge directly from traditional forms of protest. Consequently, any critical analysis of the movement is forsaken in favor of a blissful support without questioning anything. Who mobilizes itself? Why? How? Or a blatant contempt for buffs who do not demonstrate for good causes, as if class consciousness should magically impose itself on the proletarians. In the same time, we cannot summarize the events as a gross manipulation of the far right based on nothing but wind and creating a completely artificial social discontent by means of Facebook videos. The craze for yellow vests is a symptom of the political sequence in which we find ourselves, a sequence bred by a capitalism in crisis and the dissolution of any recognizable and commonly shared workers' identity. This loss of landmarks has been brutal, and some debates within the radical left, sometimes more attached to a fantasized past than to the understanding of the complex class composition of current social struggles, have consisted in questioning the proportion of proletarians using a car and are thus directly affected by the rise of the price of diesel. They very often return to the reactionary fantasy of a good old rural peasant France where the majority of the poor would live, the concept of the proletariat quickly slipping through the cracks. In our opinion, it is more relevant to focus on the political content of this movement and on what it practically translates, unquote. This is a long piece that I'm sure demonstrates the rigor that communists are loved for around the world.
December 1st, Pushing the Disorder Further, from Ediciones Inéditos, a translated blog post by Carbure. Unlike other pieces and my own cynical self, the commies here propose that revolt is not owned by the most conservative aspects of it, and that the Yellow Vest Revolt's conservative beginnings have been superseded. Quote, interclassism has, under pressure, turned into a unity between those who know, either clearly or in a confused way, that they can expect nothing from this society, that they were relegated to the banlieue, shipwrecked in the nightmare of the peri-urban pavilion, and RSA recipients who survived by collecting chestnuts in Ardèche. It was necessary to watch the dead army of the trade union march go by at Place Bastille, hidden behind its flags and its slogans, affirming the particularity of its workmen, and feel the total indifference of those who, whether in yellow vests or not, were walking aimlessly but together in Paris, to understand how much the old workers' movement, its unions, its representatives, and its demands are a thing of the past. There will be no social convergence. This movement did not come to be from leftist reason, and it will never be a social movement. That era is gone. It is no longer a question of anti-racism or anti-fascism, of left or right, when the only thing to be done is burn everything, and to know with whom you can accomplish this. This state of affairs is as much about civil war as it is about revolutionary overcoming. To take the step that leads from insurrection to revolution is to walk on the blade of a sword. Unquote. So there is some proof that some commies have hope.
Imprisoned hacktivist Jeremy Hammond bumped a guard with a door and got thrown in solitary confinement. From The Intercept, a site inspired by Edward Snowden for fearless, adversarial journalism. This is the same story as A-News got from Hammond's defense team last week. It's good that it's getting a bit more mainstream play. Good luck to Jeremy, and in case you didn't hear me before, write an anarchist prisoner today! Quote, the guard claims that Hammond hit him with a door, stood his ground, and pushed his shoulder into the guard. The head of Hammond's support network said the prison guard's account is overblown. Jeremy says that he was exiting his unit through a door that has no windows, and could not see the guard on the other side, and, as he's exiting, bumped the guard with the door. Grace North told The Intercept, the guard immediately grabbed Jeremy and threw him up against the wall and dragged him down to solitary, with no handcuffs, without calling for backup, which is against prison protocol, and Jeremy has been there ever since. Unquote.
Network case suspects go on hunger strike, from Anonymous. Quote, Tulentsev and Chernov went on hunger strike on November 29th, as reported by the Parents Network, a support group established by the mothers and fathers of the young men accused of involvement in a terrorist community that allegedly was planning an armed uprising during the March 2018 presidential election and the 2018 FIFA World Cup held in Russia this past summer. It was on November 29th that wardens put Chelentsev in solitary, demanding he admit to breaking the rules by talking with other inmates during yard time. He responded by going on hunger strike, and Chernov joined him as token of support and solidarity. On November 30th, Wardens again tried to bargain with Chelentsev and threaten him. The parents' network notes that the pressure on their sons has increased now that the suspects are officially reviewing the case file, unquote. There are suggestions for how to help at the end of this reformist but entirely touching and scary piece.
Nothing to syndicate against the democracy of work and the work of democracy from its going down. This is a thoughtful piece by Anonymous, critiquing anarcho-syndicalism from someone who seems sympathetic to it. Unlike the vast majority of pieces on IGD, this is thoughtful and theoretical, even if a lot of it isn't really getting to the point, i.e., it talks about environmental issues in a sort of odd tangent. I mean, sure, they're on our minds these days, but it doesn't speak to the topic. But okay. It's also personal and mentions the author's own background and current life issues. The negatives, it doesn't say much new. The bulk of the piece is explaining how things are, not suggestions for how they would be better. And it's not particularly pointed about anarcho-syndicalism, more about a variety of perspectives, from Graeber's bullshit jobs to Wilderson's Afro-pessimism. That's fine. Pieces that pull together disparate perspectives to ponder our lives are perfectly worthwhile. It's just not what I thought I was getting from a criticism of anarcho-syndicalism. The point of the article seems to be the following. Quote, "As anarchists, it is taken for granted that we are struggling to abolish rather than democratize the state. But a strange blind spot continues to exist for many, who frame their efforts as a struggle to democratize rather than abolish the economy," unquote. And they end, more or less, with this. Quote, "Returning to the questions at hand, I admit that the criticisms in this piece attack the question of worker self-management from very different directions and harbor internal conflicts with each other. In this sense, I am not presenting a singular program, but rather a set of different, but related, problems fundamental to the syndicalist project. Frankly, I'm still thinking my way through all these problems and what they mean for the day-to-day struggles of which I'm a part. I'm immediately skeptical of grand, universalizing theories that claim to offer the perfect scientific formula, and are more comfortable in the negative role of active, pessimist, and experimenter," unquote. Makes sense.
Audio and video. Free Radical Radio, Books Podcast, The Unique and Its Property by Max Stirner, A Close Reading, Part 4. An hour. Three dude folks. Mostly really two, but also a head nodder. This is my favorite episode so far, but I have no idea why. The takeaway is that one compares Stirner's writing to Buddhist koans, and the three of them appreciate the incoherence and contradictions of the text in a way that makes one wonder what makes those attributes worthy and when it is just a sign of bad writing. Not saying that Stirner is a bad writer or a sloppy thinker, just saying that if we can get benefit from contradictions and being messy, then perhaps we can benefit from anything. Perhaps the benefit is in the reading more than in the writing. Ha, just kidding.
Anarchy Radio, December 4th, 2018. An hour. Jay-Z talks about the yellow vests and stuff. His sound guy deflates him about the horrors of current youth habits. That was funny.
The Final Straw, Rural Organizing in Appalachia. Quote, "This week on The Final Straw Radio, we're sharing an interview with two members of Rural Organizing and Resilience, or ROAR, an anti-racist and mutual aid organization that's based in Madison County, North Carolina. Madison County is just north of Asheville and very Appalachian, with a small population that's sparsely populated in remote hollers and small towns. For the hour, Matt and Janet talk about anti-racist organizing, community efforts, misconceptions about rural people and Appalachians in particular, radical history, harm reduction, and material outreach efforts ongoing in western North Carolina. You can find out more about their project and contact them via their website, ruralorganizing.wordpress.com," unquote.
Video, Treble 17, Mad Worlds, Redefining Sanity Through Struggle, 33 minutes, quote, "In this month's episode of Treble, Submedia talks to people who are pushing back against this reality, refusing to accept the notion that mental unwellness is the result of one person's brain chemistry. They instead recognize the fundamentally social and interconnected nature of people and our problems. Rather than allowing interventions to remain the territory of psychiatrists and police, our guests are reclaiming traditions, experimenting with self-therapy collectives, and building relationships rooted in care and trust that form the resilient foundation so necessary for communities engaged in struggle."
Topic of the week, Education Revisited. This week, we're revisiting an old topic, and bringing up some new ones within it. Education is an indoctrination and also is seen as a rite of passage in society, one that often leads down a path towards work, the military, or prison. Have you considered what an ideal anarchist school would look like? Where would you want your kids to go? An anarchist free school? A Waldorf school? A Montessori school? Public school? Another alternative school? Or something else altogether? What does this look like? What has your experience been as an anarchist parent with anarchists with children in modern school schooling and education? And if you're younger, a teenager, what is your experience like in secondary school or the later college years? Or was it like? Are you an anarchist teacher / professor? How's that going? Do you have a hot take on the current institution of education in the U.S. or elsewhere? The student debt crisis? A warning to students of all ages? Charter schools? Life after school in the workplace? Vocational training versus the college general education? The school to prison pipeline to the younger ages as current popular subject within education? Or another topic coming up in conversations? You know, I hate topic of the weeks like this. It's like there's 20 questions.
Do you want to pick start one. It over?
No, it's fine. So what's your thought? And you should bring your chair a little closer.
Well, I don't have any children.
Yeah, but you're a teacher.
And I've taught in a variety of schools on both coasts.
Yeah, have you taught Montessori?
Or anything? Not like taught that? Montessori. I teach secondary school. I've only ever taught secondary. But I've taught in public middle schools and high schools on both coasts. And I've taught as well a charter school. And I've taught as well a private parochial school.
So what do you consider to be an ideal school? What would that look like?
So if I'm honest, the surprising thing about this, and I'm going to remark in a really, really narrow way. If I had a child, in a lot of ways, the school I would want them to go to is the private parochial school, because the kids there were the most healthy and well-rounded, confident, and just interesting to be around and not neurotic.
In other words, they hadn't been fucked by the school system. It was somewhere else far away.
Yeah, I think what I took from that, you know, and I don't know, but I had given it a lot of thought. I mean, every day I worked there for 1 year and then I couldn't take it. You know, it was not a good fit. But it was astonishing to me how much a small community with shared values and parents who all knew each other. Okay, let me give you, the kids felt safe, one. They'd known those teachers since they grew up. If I'd stayed, like, they would have known me since they were 4 in the preschool, and they would have had me until they were 12 and went to college. That is how most of the teachers there were. They were getting basically free tuition for their own kids, and these kids had grown up alongside their own kids, and it was really an insular community. But this, I wouldn't have predicted this, but...
And it was Islamic. It wasn't Christian.
It was Islamic. It wasn't Christian. And just to give some demographics about the school, this was not here in the Bay Area where we are. This is in a different state, but it was a situation similar to a Silicon Valley situation. It was a high-tech area, where you had a diverse group of families, but quite a big population parents earning a high income and having multiple graduate degrees and so on. So, you know, doctors, lawyers, and especially engineers and physicians. So these were the students of mainly engineers and physicians. With both, it was interesting. With both parents educated, all the parents knowing each other, the students knowing the teachers their whole life, and the students being comfortable with each other, and then the shared values, the kids just seemed happier and more relaxed every day. Many of them were going right on to college to do like a dual degree at the age of 18. So they were kind of mediocre kids, I think, if you were to like IQ test all of them. But I do think the shared values, the safe space and everything, it was kind of... I was astonished. I would not have predicted that. The whole thing seemed strange to me, and yet it was astonishingly working well. Now, the other half of the demographic there were refugee kids from really low incomes. Mm-hmm. One family had 10 children all in that school from the same family. I clearly remember... delightful family, but I clearly remember that it was a different set of challenges, because I phoned Dad one time and he was like, I just have 9 other children and I don't have time to help little so-and-so with her homework. What do you want to ask about that? Or another school where I worked?
The question again was, what would your ideal school look like?
So I think the thing to take from that is a Bolo Bolo type thing. Somehow they're with a small group, shared expectations.
Shared understanding of the world. I mean, in other words, you're against multiculturalism.
I can only say that I've worked at this many schools and those kids seem the least neurotic and the most just generally happy-go-lucky. Mm-hmm. And I mean every day in a row. We could actually walk in as secondary teachers with a fairly rigorous curriculum. I mean, we weren't messing around. As I said, every single one of these kids was expected to go to college and went to college. And a lot of them at a slightly early age, and a lot of them, as I said, doing dual degrees or, you know. But at the same time, what I'm trying to say is every day we could pretty much feel them out and see how they wanted to go the lesson to go.
Well, compare that to the schools that would be considered highly multicultural that you've taught at.
So I'm going to say at every other school where I've taught, whether it was high income, low income, regardless which coast, and regardless whether they were 12-year-olds or up to 19-year-olds, you're just dealing with a different dynamic, like a more mixed dynamic in the room. And I don't know what better word to use than to say that you're dealing with everybody's neuroses. I mean, I probably get that word from meditation training or something. It's like a real Buddhist American type word to use. But I mean, you just have this eccentric child and this eccentric, and I mean, in ways where they're suffering, not in ways where they're interesting and eccentricity is a fine thing. I mean, in like this one's suffering in that regard, this one's suffering in that regard, and let's all be in the big room suffering together is really the public school experience in general. I like my job just fine, but that's if I'm being honest.
Right, which isn't exactly putting the blame on multiculturalism. It's putting the blame on something else, like...
I think it's putting the blame on something that I've heard you mention before, and I don't know if it was in the context of this podcast or another. Something about when we're just randomly located together in today's cities and neighborhoods, that's sort of a really artificial way of actually being together. We happen to live on the same street or be in the same end of the school system or something, but it doesn't mean that we can relate to each other, ever know each other, have the same interests or needs or any or identity, but I don't take a lot of interest in identity. It's not my shtick. So I think the kids are, I mean, the, you know, public school kids are forced to go there. And it is maybe one of the most...
So are the parochial school kids.
No. I mean, there's some things to say about that. They're not very interesting, but these families had they had self-selected. Uh-huh. The parents
The parents self-selected, not the children.
As well, and this is definitely critiquable, while I was only there for 1 year, there were two or three kids who, as an aside, I really liked and felt that they were splendid people in all regards, and I mean all. And they were three African-American boys, and they were deemed to not be a good fit by their own behaviors, decisions, which were not bad decisions, but they were not as fitting in as well. Mm-hmm. And by African-American, I mean not... with descendants in the U.S., I mean from Africa.
Oh, they're not African-American.
They're African immigrant, or their parents were, but mm-hmm. they have American citizenship and all that.
Right.
So, and I'm just going to say, I think I still have all the kids from that school on my Facebook. I didn't say, let me come back, but by... the community being really transparent and everybody knowing each other, I mean that it was a soft requirement that I have a Facebook account and add the kids. This is exactly the opposite of a public school.
Yes, it is.
It's totally inappropriate. I mean, I have friends in some communities, some school systems and states where they have a pseudonym because they want to have Facebook for baby pictures, but they can't have it because it's against their work policy or whatever. So there, I still have some Facebook I never use. That's a different one because it's got all of the kids on it. Now, what I was going to go toward is at least one of the boys went out and it might have been probably his junior year, and he did his senior year at public school. He essentially got kicked out. Mm. Not for doing anything wrong, just, I'll say, quote unquote, not like a perfect fit. Like, he was, maybe they thought he might not go to college or something. Like, that would be the hardest critique you could make of this child. He's a wonderful child. I've been in his home. I knew his mom. Just a great person. And here's, by objective measures, how flexible and resilient and popular of a young man he was. He went on and played on the football team at the public high school his senior year and was the king of one of the dances, you know, the homecoming, the prom or something. And, it, you know, and that has gone on to college. I mean, he's totally successful.
Okay, but let's re-answer the core question. So taking away what you've said, your ideal school would look like something that maybe exists more in a Bolo Bolo or a single, a more singular community.
I think that's where
So that's one thing. Two other components of this ideal school system.
Well,
would you have separate subjects, or would, like, isn't it Montessori or Waldorf?
I just
where you blend all the subjects together.
I believe you. I just don't, because I haven't raised my own children, I've never ever looked closely at Montessori or Waldorf, so I don't want to mischaracterize them or misunderstand them.
But do you like the idea?
So the idea
of students going to class to class and having things be so separate like that?
I think there's something to be said for a routine for me. Like, on my days off, I tend to be a little more productive and happy at the end of the day. Usually, if I've kind of gotten up, brushed my teeth, gotten dressed, had a breakfast, you know, like some semblance of a routine that I've set for myself. So there's something to be said for people having routines. But I think the ideal that is hard for me to hit every day in the public school, I'm going to answer it this way, is the ideal of everybody in the room not being in agreement on anything, but being like the kids have chosen the lesson, basically, like that the lesson is genuinely something that people want to do and they want to be there. And whether or not they pick the topic, they have some relation to the topic, it's relevant to them. And they're enjoying being around other people who are doing what they're doing. And I saw that most days. I mean, I could say every day, maybe not every hour of every day, at the private school. It's pretty hard to hit that goal at the larger public school with the full-size classroom.
So you're talking, how big were the classes in the private school? Like a dozen?
I don't feel that I had more than a dozen in the high school class.
And in your last public class, you had over 30 every class.
I mean, I have a dozen now, but I'm at an alternative program. And in every other time, yes, I've had
over 30.
Yeah.
How many is the most?
Well, on my roster, maybe 33 has been the most. Some years, when I've had the energy for it and everything, I've been that teacher where the other teachers or the new teachers or the sick teachers or the cranky teachers could send the kids. So sometimes I've ended up with up to 40 kids. Like, one day I looked around my middle school classroom and I had 40 heads in the room. The kids were just squeezed in there because the other teachers up and down the hall had been sending me a kid. So, you know,
Okay, so what else would be in your ideal anarchist school or ideal school?
So definitely.
Would your social studies curriculum be?
Well, I would blend the age groups. I'll tell you, in the alternative program I'm in right now, I have 9th through 12th graders, and they've picked their own thing they wanted to do about the Holocaust, and they just know what it is. They don't actually know anything too much about it. That's not just sensational. And so, you know, they picked their own topic, and they've been sitting there for 1 month, I think now, maybe 3 weeks, just learning about that. And I have 9th through 12th graders in each small group. And I tell you what, they're learning social skills, and the ones with the weird, immature, you know, 9th grade behaviors, they're trying to impress the 12th graders. And that might sound simple or unnecessary or something, but it's sort of huge. Like, it feels a little bit natural to me to blend the age groups.
So your ideal school wouldn't be that radically different than what you already have?
Maybe. The kids I'm with right now are there because there are not other fits for them.
Sure, but I'm saying generally.
But I think we've hit on the main things. I think this is something I've never thought through, because I've never wanted to go into administration or start my own whatever, charter school or something. That's never been my interest. But I do think we've grabbed a couple things. We've said family and students and teachers and parents all knowing each other and having some kind of shared interests and reason for being there and expectations a little bit. But then on the other hand, flexibility and the students choosing their own, expressing their own interests and following their own paths and blending some different age groups.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Stay in school and stay focused. Let the truth be your own focus. Then by getting an education, you'll be your own hostess.
Your turn.
Learning knowledge is power. Then you'll grow like a beautiful flower. You'll grow in education like a beautiful flower. You'll grow every hour.
Welcome to Redacted, the only show that takes the feedback of our listeners into consideration. This is Suds, and this week it is only going to be myself, as after 6 months of doing recording for this podcast, we have decided to take a special kind of pivot and change our direction. We're not going to be ending the show. What it is that we are going to be doing is exploring a new route. One of the things that seems to have been working for us has been taking the questions that people from the IRC, that people from the other social media platforms that we have been using into consideration. And so what we would like to begin doing is essentially wrapping the entire program around this concept of people being able to ask questions and having anarchists from multiple backgrounds, multiple perspectives, answer them. So the way that we're going to be doing this is, rather than using the redacted name, what we're going to be including is a brand new identity, which is going to be both a username on places like Twitter and YouTube, later on some other social media platforms, but we're just going to be starting with those two to start with. Essentially, it's going to be hashtag AskAnarchists, or the username AskAnarchists. If someone were to use this username, or if they were to tag this user on one of these social media accounts with a particular question that they were wondering about for the case of gaining perspective from anarchists around at least North America, as we currently have the largest population for this show, we will look through all of those questions and try to choose either one to do an entire episode around, or multiple questions that we will be doing during the same episode, and then explore them as we move forward. So this week is going to be a very short episode, as this is essentially the announcement that what we're going to be doing is moving forward with this new sort of model. And all I can really do is say that I hope that folks are interested in joining the conversation. We have already had 2 weeks of people who have been asking questions and having them answered on the segment. And what we would like to do moving forward is explore this with volition. So we look forward to hearing from you. And this is Suds for this week, signing out.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by Chisel. We thank Aragorn and Ariel for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and materials are available at littleblackcart.com. For news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, go to anarchistnews.org.